Book of Judges, Uncensored, Episode 3. We saw previously, in the first year, we saw that Kushan Rishathaim from Aram, which is basically northeast of the Holy Land, he came and dominated the Jews, and then we were saved by Othniel ben Kenaz, the first judge. Then, after he died, so that the Jews were again dominated by Moab, which is to the east of Eretz Yisrael, and then they were saved by Ehud ben Gera, the second judge. And then afterwards we talked about the third judge, Shamgar ben Anas, who defeated the Plishtim. And the Plishtim, if you don't know, live in the southwest of Eretz Yisrael. So that's like in the Gaza area. There are actually five major Plishti cities. You know the five major Plishti cities are? There's Gaza, Gas, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Ekron. Those are the five major Plishti cities all around the southwest of Eretz Yisrael along the coast. So we had the Plishtim. And then we said after Shamgar ben Anas and after Ehud ben Gera died, so again the Jewish people were doing wrong and the roller coaster fell down, came to a crash, and now we're about to begin the fourth chapter of Sefer Shoftim. So the fourth chapter begins like this. Jewish people continued to do bad in the eyes of Hashem. The Ehud Meis. Ehud was already dead. Right? Ehud was the second judge. And Hashem sold the Jewish people in the hands of Yovin, the king of Canaan. Hashem Molach Bechatzor, who is king in Chatzor, which is all in the north of Eretz Yisrael. Chatzor is in the north of Eretz Yisrael. I'm not sure if this guy, this Yovin Malach Canaan, the Canaanite king Yovin, was a king. His main territory was north of Eretz Yisrael, which the Jews never really ended up conquering, which is still considered part of Eretz Canaan, even if it's not necessarily part of Eretz Yisrael. Because Canaan had a bunch of sons. His oldest son, Sidon, founded the city Sidon, which is up north in Lebanon, which is outside of the border, the traditional borders of Eretz Yisrael, that of what they conquered. Okay, so it could be that this Yovin Melech Canaan was king north of Eretz Yisrael, or it could be this is from one of the pockets of unconquered territory within Eretz Canaan, within Eretz Yisrael, that the Jews didn't conquer, and this guy became stronger, and he was able to expand his sphere of influence. So Hashem sold the Jews in the hands of this Canaanite king Yovin Melech Canaan. Besar Tzva'oi Sisra, and the name of his general was Sisra. So there's interesting midrashim about this guy Sisra, without getting too much into the details, but there's a medrash called Medrash Abba Gurion on Megillas Esther, and it says in Medrash Abba Gurion that when Sisra was 30 years old, he had already conquered the entire world. That's sort of rabbinic hyperbole about him conquering the entire world, because it doesn't seem like, I mean, first of all, he wasn't king over the entire world, he was just the general. But the idea is that he was a very strong person, even from a young age, he was a very influential military leader. So Yovin, the king of Canaan, and his general Sisra, they had taken over the Jews. Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem, and the Jewish people cried out to Hashem, Kitcha me'oyis rechav barzel loy, because Sisra and Yovin, they had 900 iron chariots, which was, in modern day terms, that would be like some sort of major tank or something like that, right? An iron chariot is like a some sort of modern tank. And he put pressure, he put force on the Jewish people for 20 years. So the Jewish people were under the dominion of this guy, Yovin, the king of Canaan, and his general Sisra. Okay. Now we talk about the next judge. This is the fourth judge. She is the only female judge that we have.
Why is that?
It's a good question. What do you think?
We are sexist.
I don't know. This is the way it came out. I'll give you a good answer. We're going to see that Devorah did something, at least according to some opinions, she did something which merited her being above the rest. And that's why because she did a certain thing, she has a special merit that she became a prophet. Maybe that's why she became a judge as well. We'll see. We'll try to understand her a little bit. So this is in Pasuk Dalet. Udvara Isha Nevia. Devora was a prophetess. She was a woman prophet. Eshes Lapidos. Simplistically speaking, that means she was the wife of somebody named Lapidos. He shafta Yisrael ba'isi. She was the one judging the Jewish people at that time. And the Navi tells us she would sit tachas toimer Devora. She would sit underneath something called the palm tree of Devora. And all the Jewish people would come to her for justice over there, for judgment. She would judge them sitting underneath this palm tree. Okay, so there's a few different points of here. First of all, he said, Devora Isha Nevia. She was a woman who was a prophet. So the Gemara Megillah on Daf Yudal and Ralph says, it's a famous Gemara actually, at least in certain circles.
In certain circles.
The Gemara says that there were seven Nevi'os. There were seven female prophets. Right? They are Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. Those are the seven female prophetesses.
Did you say Ruth?
No, he didn't say Ruth. Should I say it again? Sarah, yeah. Miriam, Devorah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. Sarah is Avram Avinu's wife. Miriam was Moshe Rabbeinu's sister. Devorah is the lady we're talking about. Hannah was the mother of Shmuel HaNavi. She was married to someone named Elkanah. Abigail was one of David HaMelech's wives. Huldah was a prophetess who lived at the end of the first temple period. She was cousins with Yirmiyahu HaNavi, and she was one of the people that prophesied about the upcoming destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash. And Esther, we know from the book of Esther.
And Leah.
Leah is not one of the seven prophetesses. There's a lot of different questions. You know, Rivka had a prophecy where she said that she's going to lose two of her sons on the same day. So people ask, okay, why isn't Rivka included in this list? There's a lot of different people you can ask, why are they not included in this list? But this is the list that the Gemara gives.
It's the famous list.
This is the famous list.
In some circles.
In some circles. Now, the Gemara makes an interesting inference over here. Because the Navi introduces Devorah as Eshes Lapidos. She's the wife of somebody named Lapidos. Now, as the Marsha explains, usually the wife is known by her more famous husband. Okay, but over here, the Navi introduces the wife, the husband, as the husband of a more famous woman. Right? So the Gemara sort of like flips it from the usual norm. So the Gemara understands from that it's not meant to be taken literally, and Eshes Lapidos doesn't literally mean that her husband was named Lapidos. What the Gemara says, my Eshes Lapidos, what does it mean? She's the wife of Lapidos. Shahaisa Eisa Psilos LaMikdash, because she used to make the psilos, the wicks, for the Mikdash, which on the side they say is a mistake, not supposed to say Mikdash, because there was no base of Mikdash at this time. It's supposed to say Mishkan, like the Mishkan was in Shiloh throughout the entire time of the judges. So Devorah is called Eshes Lapidos because she used to make the wicks for the Mishkan, and a lapid is a torch, right? So she's called the wife of the torch because she's the one who made the wicks. The Marsha explains that the Navi is calling her Eshes Lapidos to explain to us what she did that was so significant that made her merit to become a prophetess. Marsha says because she went and she took this effort in making the wicks for the Mishkan, so she became a prophetess. That's what Marsha says. So maybe we could extend that and say that's also why she was so outstanding that she became a judge and there were no other female judges. Maybe. I don't know. There's another Medrash that's brought in the Yalkut Shemayni and also in the Tanan Eliyahu that understands it literally as if Devorah's husband was named Lapidos. And the Medrash says that this guy Lapidos is another name for somebody else whose name is Barak, who we're going to see, he's the Jewish general, we're going to see later in the story. So Lapidos / Barak, according to this Medrash, was actually the husband of Devorah. Even so, Devorah seems to be the main player over here. She's the main protagonist in the story, and her husband is sort of secondary. Now the question is like, that's still going against the norm in a certain way. Usually it's the husband, the man in all the stories in Tanakh is usually the main character, and then the wife is sort of like a supporting character, right? So we hear it's still going to come out different than usual. Here again, Devorah is still the main character, and Lapido / Barak is a secondary character. So why is that? So the Medrash explains that this is a sort of a different spin on what the Gemara says. The Medrash says that her husband was an Amoritz, he was an ignoramus, and she had encouraged him to go do something fruitful with his life, to go do something productive. She encouraged him to make the wicks for the Mishkan, and because of that, she's the driving force behind him. So because of that, she becomes like the main character. She's the one who's behind his success. But, you know, behind every successful man is a woman, so she was the woman behind his success. So that's why she's the focus over here. Now, that's not like the Gemara. The Gemara, and also Rashi quotes it over here, that says that she was the one making the wicks. But this Medrash is saying that her husband was the one making the wicks, but it was because of her encouragement that he ended up doing it. You could even say that that's what the Gemara means. When the Gemara says that she made the wicks, it could mean that, not that she literally made it, but she was the one who brought it about in an indirect way by getting her husband to do it. There's also, the same Medrash also says that this guy, Lapidos / Barak, even though he was an Amoritz, he was also Shimesh Zekanim B'chaya Yoshua. He was a person who attended to the Zekanim, to the elders that lived in the time of Yeshua. That lived in the lifetime of Yeshua. So even though he was an Amoritz and he himself was not a learned person, but he was involved in supporting the learned people. He would be maybe like the guy who like brought him the chair, the guy who brought him the soda, which disappeared somehow, and these type of things. What?
You want soda?
No, I don't. I don't drink soda. I only drink water.
No, it's carbonated water.
I know, but the carbon is like... I also have a canker sore, so that's why I'm talking funny, and that's why I don't like eating so much when I have canker sores. Fine. The Gemara says... It says in the Pasuk that she sat underneath a date tree and she judged the Jewish people. Right? So the Gemara asks, why did she have to sit under a date tree? What is this? Why did she sit under a date tree? So the Gemara says, "Amar b'Shimon ben Avi Shalom, b'Shum Yichud." Because of Yichud, right? She didn't have like some sort of room where she would accept visitors, and then she would litigate different cases in her house or in her room. Rather, she did it underneath this date tree, out in the open, so that there wouldn't be any problems of Yichud. Tesis explains, when the Jewish people would come to her for judgment, so there wouldn't be a problem with Yichud because it was outside underneath the date tree. So the problem is like this. If you look a little bit about the halachas of Yichud, so one man and one woman is biblically forbidden to be alone together. Right? That's Yichud Midoraisa, biblically forbidden. Right? Now, one man, one woman, and two men is allowed. It's permitted. Right? It's permitted. One woman with two men is permitted, according to the Torah, right? Even according to rabbinical law. That's not a problem of Yichud. Right? So now, if she's doing a judgment, right, she's serving as a judge in some sort of litigation, some sort of case, so there's always going to be two people fighting. Right? There's going to be two men fighting, and then her. So what would be the problem of Yichud? Two men with one woman is not a problem of Yichud. So what's the Gemara saying? That she had to sit underneath this date tree, the date tree of Devorah, in order to avoid problems of Yichud. It's not a problem. There's two men and one woman, so that's not Yichud.
Not necessarily that every time there's going to be two men.
She's saying one of the litigants might be a woman. That's what you're saying. And then two women with one man could be a problem.
That's not what I'm saying, but that's a good point.
Okay, that could be... So some of the farshim say a different point. They say the halacha is that one woman with two men is allowed only if the two men are what we call kosher, the kosher people. But if the two men are parutz, they're, let's say, call them perverted, perverted, two perverted guys, so then a woman is not allowed to be alone with those two men. Okay? So there's a Mishnah in Mesachas Avos when it's giving guidance to judges how you're supposed to treat litigants. So the Mishnah says, "V'yu ba'alei din amdin lefanecha, yu be'enecha, kishiyu ba'alei din amdin lefanecha, yu be'enecha kirishoyim." When ba'alei din, when litigants are standing in front of you for litigation, you should look at them in your eyes as if both of them are equally evil. Both of them are rishoyim. Right? Mishnah Avos, Perak Aleph, Mishnah Ches. So it could be, this is what the Yaibet says, Rabbi Yaakov Emden. He says that when Devorah was educating these cases with these people, so she would look at them as if they were Rishayim. So even if it's two men with one woman, but maybe these guys are Rishayim or perverted or whatever, and she doesn't want to do Yichud with them. So because of that, she had to do her litigation underneath a date tree.
There's two underneath women the palm tree. And one man, okay?
Two women with one man, I believe is not okay.
Is it being a date palm like significant at all? Or is that just the nearest trade?
They were dating that.
It probably is significant, but I don't remember recall offhand somebody saying something specific. I mean, Rashi says that it was that this was her business. She had she was next to the city of Yericho, and she had a business of selling dates or whatever. So that was her parnasa. So beyond that, I'm not aware of any sources. But there is an interesting thing that there's two characters in Devorah and Tanakh. Yeah, there's this Devorah, the judge, and then there's another Devorah in the book of Genesis, in Sefer Bereishis, the wet nurse of Rivka, her name is Devorah. Devorah Minekes Rivka. Right? And she's a very minor character, but it says in the Torah that when she died, they buried her underneath a tree. So it says, Parshas Vayishlach. It doesn't say date tree. It says Tachas Alon. And Alon is a different type of, I think it's an oak tree maybe. I'm not sure what the article translates it as. Where is it?
So it's possible that it could be a date tree.
It's in Bereishis, Paraglamet Hay. Pasuk Dalet. No, not Pasuk Dalet. Pasuk Ches. Vatamas Devorah Minekes Rivka. Devorah, the wet nurse of Rivka, died. Vatikover Mitachas Leveis El, Tachas Ha'alon. And they buried her near Beis El, or underneath Beis El, underneath the Alon, which article translates as a plateau. Which is not a type of a tree, but. Rashi said, whatever, the others bring that it was a tree. V'yikra Shem Shmoy Alon Bachus, and they called it Alon Bachus, the weeping, the place of the weeping. Okay. So the Barbanel actually says it's the same place. So like, this Devorah and that Devorah, where the original Devorah was buried, is where the second Devorah is judging her cases. One more point before we go on to the main story over here about Devorah. Now, according to Halacha, there's a rule that anybody who is disqualified from being a witness is not allowed to be a judge. And that's the Halacha. If you can't be a witness, you can't be a judge.
Of course, right?
Now, the problem is that women are not valid witnesses to give Halacha testimony. They can't be an Edom. In Pirkei de Beliezer, it says that this is one of the punishments that women got because Chava ate from the tree of knowledge and she gave it to other Mishan. So one of her punishments was that they became posel edus. They became disqualified from giving testimony. So if she's disqualified from giving testimony, she should also be disqualified from being a judge. Yet over here it clearly says that she was judging the Jewish people and she was a judge. So how can that be?
She was an exception to the rule.
She was an exception to the rule. What do you mean?
I don't know.
But what justifies the exception? The rule is the rule, right? So I have to explain what justifies it. This question is not my question. This question is dealt with. You know, there's at least tesis in Bava Kama Daf Tesvav. There's a tesis in Nida Daf Nun. The Ramban, Rajba, Ritva, Ran, Mukhi Yosef, and Shavuos, Daf Lamed, they all discuss this question. They come up with a lot of different answers. But to put it into bullet points, there's basically three answers. The first answer is that she wasn't actually a judge. She was sort of like a consultant for the judges. She would like tell the judges how to give them guidance and how to rule, but she wasn't actually technically a judge herself. She's sort of leading the judges. That's one answer. The other answer is because she was a prophet, so it's different. Right? She was a prophetess, so we said she's a prophetess. She gets special nevuah from Hashem, so that's different. The problem with this answer is that there's a halacha that says lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not in the heavens. So even if you're a prophet, that doesn't mean that you're like going to be above the laws of the Torah. Unless you could say that her prophecy was that she should be a judge, even though under the normal rules she wouldn't be a judge. You could say it like that. But the third answer basically is that there's a halacha that even if somebody is puzzled for being a dayan, even if somebody is disqualified from being a judge, but if the litigants accept upon themselves this person for arbitration, so then his rulings will become binding. Right? So let's say I have, I don't know, let's say I have a brother, yeah, and you and me are in a fight. So we can go to a regular judge, or we can go to my brother. My brother also happens to be a judge. The problem is that usually, according to halacha, if the judge is a brother of one of the litigants, so then he can't be a valid judge for this case. Right? But if you agree, and I agree, and we'll go to my brother, we both agree to it, and we agree that we're going to listen to whatever he says, so then even though he's an invalid judge in this case, but since we accepted him upon ourselves, so then he becomes a valid judge according to halacha. So what Taisus and Bava Kama seems to be saying is that even though technically according to halacha Devorah was an invalid judge because she's a woman and women can't be judges, but because she was a prophet and she was so prominent and everyone agreed that she was the spiritual leader of her generation, so people would come to her and they would do it, they would willingly submit to whatever she decides in her arbitration. So they would agree to her as a judge, even though she wasn't technically, halakhically allowed to be a judge, but once they agree to it, so then it becomes halakhically binding, whatever she rules. That's more or less the framework of the discussion. Got it? Okay, so now we get into the story of Devorah and Barak and the war against Yavin Melech Canaan and his general Sisera. So it says, this is in Shoftim Perek Dalid, we're in Pasuk Vav now. Devorah sent forth and she called up this guy named Barak ben Avinoam from Kedesh Naphtali. So Barak is from the Shevet of Naphtali, and it seems that Devorah also was from the tribe of Naphtali. The tribe of Naphtali is located, the territory of the tribe of Naphtali is located, we don't have our map over here, but whatever. It's in the Chumash. It's located in the northeast corner or quarter of the Holy Land. Where's it at?
I can't find it.
That's only the new ones.
Oh, it doesn't have the map.
Oh, you know what? This has a map. Yeah.
This isn't new?
Maybe there's one below that?
Yeah, this is beautiful. Yeah. This is a map of all the tribal territories. And here's Naphtali, so it's like in the northeast corner, northwest corner of Eretz Yisrael. And Zvulun and Yisachar are also going to be involved in this fight. And they're not that so far away from Naphtali. So Naphtali, Zvulun, and Yisachar. Okay. So she calls this guy Barak ben Avinoam, who, according to the Medrash that we mentioned before, Barak is the same person as Lapidos, who happens to be her husband. And she says to him, Halotziva Hashem alekei Yisrael, did Hashem, the God of Israel, not command that you should go out to the mountain of Tavor and take with you 10,000 men from Naphtali and from Zvulun? And Hashem said that I'm going to draw the Sisera and his and Yavin, Sisera and Yavin, the Canaanite army, I'm going to draw them out to Nachal Kishon and I'm going to give them to your hands. So Devorah gives this prophecy to Barak. She says, take 10,000 men, go to Mount Tabor, and Hashem is going to bring out the Canaanite army and you're going to defeat them. Yeah. Now, Barak has a very interesting response to what Devorah says. Barak says to her, if you come with me, I'll go. If you don't come with me, I'm not going. If you come with me, I'm going to go. If you don't come with me, I'm not going. That very funny response. Devorah, she's the prophet. Right? She says, go, and you're going to be successful. Right? And he says, if you come with me, I'll go. If you don't come with me, I'm not going. What's happening over here? What do you guys think? The Mufarshim don't really address this directly. Like, what was he thinking? But, I mean, the Rabbah says that because he knew that she was a prophetess. So he figured that if she comes with him, so he'll be even more successful. Even though she already said a prophecy that he's going to be successful. So, I don't know. Maybe this has to do with the Medrash that we mentioned, that like she was the force behind his success. So he felt like he's not going to be able to accomplish anything without her, even though she already prophesied that he's going to be successful. Okay, so what happens? She says to him, "Fine, I'll go with you. I'm going to go with you, but you should know that the glory of the victory is not going to be your glory." For Hashem is going to give over Sisera to the hands of a woman. You're not going to get the glory of the victory. It's not going to be, Barak defeated Sisera. It's going to be a woman. And spoiler alert, that's what happens. It's going to be a woman. A woman is going to be the one to defeat Sisera. So it says, Devorah went with, she got up and she went with Barak to Kedesh, which is the city in Naphtali. And Barak went and he gathered up a bunch of people from the tribe of Zvulun and Naphtali. What about Yisachar? Yisachar is a neighbor of Zvulun. So Rashi explains that they didn't really conscript the people of Yisachar into this war to be an active battle combatants, because the people of Yisachar were Torah scholars. So we don't take Torah scholars and put them in the army. It could be that they were doing certain supporting roles in the army, but Yisachar are not mentioned over here as part of the active battle. So he took these 10,000 people with him, and it was told to Sisera that Barak ben Avinoam is coming up to Har Tavor and he wants a fight. So Sisera gets out all his horse riders and his 900 iron chariots and all his army, and he goes up to Nachal Kishon and he's going to go fight with them. And Devorah says to Barak, get up, for on this day Hashem is giving Sisera to your hands. And they got up and they came down from Har Tavor with 10,000 people. And the pasuk says, Vayoham Hashem is Sisera, Veskol Rechev, Veskol Machane, Lefichoyev, Lefnei Barak. And Hashem, Yoham, Vayoham Hashem, Hashem made them confused or panicked. The entire army of Sisera, they suddenly became confused and they started panicking. And then they were able to be killed lefichayev by the sword, according in front of Barak. So Barak was able to defeat them because Hashem very actively intervened in the battle and made the Canaanite army confused. By Yoham Hashem. So there's an interesting parish called Mari Kara. Mari Kara is Rabbi Yosef Kara. He lived in the same time as Rashi. He lived in France, so he has a commentary. It's printed in this edition of the Mikra Skudalos of Sefer Shoftim. So he says, how did Hashem make them confused? Well, he did call through a voice. They heard voices. Yarem min hashamayim. There was thunder coming out, voice of thunder coming out from the heavens, and that confused them. And then they started stabbing each other. And then that's how they basically ended up losing this battle over here. Right? Hashem confused them with this thunder. It's interesting that we had like Lapidus and Barak, right? So the word Lapidus means a torch, which has to do with fire. And then his alternate name was, according to the Medrash, Barak. Now Barak means lightning, right? And now if the general's name is lightning, it's quite befitting that Hashem would confuse the opposing army by miraculously bringing thunder, because thunder and lightning usually go together, like a horse and carriage, right? And That's how they were able to defeat the Canaanite army. But the next part of the story is a very interesting thing. Barak chases after the Canaanite army, and he basically wipes out the entire army, with the Jews win this battle over here, except for Sisera. Sisera runs away. This great general, he loses his whole army. He's running away on foot, and he comes to the tent of a woman named Yael Eshes Chever Hakeni. Yael, the wife of somebody named Chever Hakeni. Hakenis are the descendants of Yisro Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, converted to Judaism. So they also were they're not Jewish by, let's say, genealogy, but they were attached to the Jewish people on the periphery, sort of. So they were sort of like attached to the Jewish people, but not really part of the Jewish people. They were allies, let's say. We'd say they're allies. They were the Jewish people's allies. So Sisera, after his whole army is defeated, he ends up running away. He goes to the tent of this lady named Yael, the wife of Chever Hakeni. And Yael comes out to greet him, and she says to him, "Oh, come into my tent, don't worry, everything will be okay." So he comes into her tent, Vayasar Elaha El Ha'ayla, he turned towards her tent, Vayitichaseyu Besmicha, and she covered him with a smicha. You know what a smicha is? A smicha is a blanket. In modern Hebrew, a smicha is a blanket. So she covered him with a blanket. What does she do? She says to him, He says to her, "Oh, give me some water. I'm very tired, very thirsty. I was just in this major battle over here." So she says, "Oh, don't worry." She gives him milk, right? And he drinks the milk, and she covers him. And he asks her, "Are there any other people over here?" And she says, "No, there's no other people." And he sort of lies down, and then she takes the stake of her tent, the peg that sort of holds the tent up, and she takes that and she smashes his head and basically kills him with it. And then Barak is chasing after Barak is in pursuit of Sisera, trying to find Sisera, and all of a sudden this Yael lady comes out of her tent and she says to Barak, "Oh, Barak, the man you're looking for, I'll show him to you." And he brings her into the tent, and she says, "Oh, there's Sisera on the floor, dead." And on that day, Hashem had subjugated Yavin, the king of Canaan, before the Jewish people. So the Jewish people won this battle. Okay. So there's a lot to discuss over here. What time is it?
5:00.
Okay. We'll do it like this. We said that Yael covered Sisera with a smicha, right? Now, how do you spell the word smicha? So the word smicha, in general, is spelled
samech.
You would think to spell it samech mem yud chaf hey, right? That's what you would think to spell. But here in the Navi, it spells it shin, not shin, sin mem yud chaf hey, right? Smicha with a sin instead of with a samech. Usually the sin and samach are interchangeable. But over here it seems that as if it's making a point over here of spelling it with a sin. And the Medrash harps on this point, and the Medrash says you should read the word not as if it says smicha, but as if it says shmi koi. Shmi koi means my name is here. Right? Koi is, or my name is thus. Right? My name is here, or my name is thus. Medrash explains that Hashem says, "My name is here to testify that Rasha Sisera never ended up touching Yael." So he never touched her. That's what the Medrash says. That's one Medrash. Now there's a famous Gemara that's brought in a few places in Shas, Yevamos Kuf Gimel, in Nazir. It's elsewhere also. I don't remember offhand. The Gemara says that Gedola Avera Lishma Mimitzvah Shalai Lishma. This is a very misunderstood concept, and we're not going to go exactly into what it means, But the Gemara says that a avera, a sin which is done with the proper intentions, is better than a mitzvah which is done with improper intentions. Right? And the Gemara brings an example from Ya'el Eshes Chever Akeni, who the Gemara says that she brought Sisera into her house, and it says the lashon of the Gemara is Shiva Beilos Bal Oisei Rasha Baisei Yom. That Rasha Sisera did 7 acts of intercourse with Ya'el on that day. Right? So that is sort of at odds with the Medrash. The Medrash says he never even touched her. The Gemara says she had relations with him 7 times on that day. Or he had relations with her 7 times on that day. And the Gemara uses this as an example that even though she shouldn't have done this, but she was doing this in order to save the Jewish people, so it's an Avera, but it's Lishma, it's with the proper intentions, so there is some sort of mila, there's some sort of advantage to doing an Avera with proper intentions. Now, this concept has been misconstrued throughout the ages. Like, for example, Shabbosai Tzvi used to have this concept called Avera Lishma, where you would specifically go out and do an Avera, whether it's adultery or whether you have to go out and dafka eat chalev, the fats of animals that you're not allowed to eat. Shabbosai Tzvi had this bracha that he would say, we make a bracha in the morning, Matir Asurim, which means that Hashem releases the people who are jailed. So he would make a bracha, Matir Isurim. Hashem is Matir Isurim. Hashem permits things which are forbidden, which is a grave perversion of what the Torah is and what Judaism stands for. Right? So he's perverting this idea of Avera Lishma. But there is this concept of Avera Lishma, whatever exactly it means, and when it is applicable, we're not getting into that. But the Gemara does say this about Ya'el, that she did what's called an Avera Lishma. So the problem is, we're left with a question. What exactly did Ya'el do? Was she with Sisera or was she not with Sisera? Was it Shmi Kai that Hashem testifies that he never even touched her? Or did he have his way with her 7 times on that day? So these two sources seem to be at odds with each other. And a lot of the Mefarshim say that, yes, it's true. It's actually a machlokas. It's a dispute between the Gemara and the Medrash. And it happens to be that if you look at the Gemara, the one who says this about Ya'el and Sisera was Rabbi Yochanan. And if you look in the Medrash, the one who says this about Ya'el not being touched by Sisera was Reish Lakish. So usually Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are the ones who argue with each other. So it makes a lot of sense to say that it was actually a machlokas between the Gemara and the Medrash, between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. That's one approach. Another approach is that Sisera didn't actually have relations with her, but he sort of felt as if he did for different reasons 7 times. Some say that he looked at her and that brought him to a certain climax, and as if he had relations with her, or he listened to her voice and it was so beautiful that he thought that he had relations with her, or that he was so drunk that he thought he was actually having relations with her but he wasn't. Different opinions like that. So that's sort of like, the Gemara says that he never actually touched her, or the Medrash says he never actually touched her, which was true, and the Gemara says that he had relations 7 times. It doesn't literally mean that he did, but it's something like that. A third opinion answers that he sent, that instead of allowing her, submitting herself to Sisera, so Ya'el actually had some control over a demon, a Sheida. She was able to send this Sheida, this demoness, at her disposal, and Sisera actually had relations with this demoness, with the Sheda. So the Medrash says that he didn't touch her because he didn't really touch her, he touched the Sheda. And the Gemara says he had relations with her 7 times. He thought he had relations with her 7 times, but really he was doing it with this Sheda. And we find a similar thing about Esther and Achashverosh. There's a Zohar that says that Esther used to send a demon to go be with Achashverosh instead of going herself to be with him. There's precedent for such an idea. The other question when we discuss Ya'el Eshes Chever Akeni is, there's a halacha that says that if a married woman has relations with another man and she's not forced into it, so then she becomes forbidden to her husband. Right? So what happens over here? Does Ya'el Eshes Chevra Keni become forbidden to her husband if she had relations with Sisera? Well, that's okay. According to the opinions that we said before, it could be it didn't happen. But according to the simple reading of the Gemara, that it did happen, so does she become forbidden to her husband?
Yes.
So some people say yes. Yeah? Because you know, even the Gemara says about Esther and Achashverosh that originally she was forced, but at some point she was going willingly to try to convince Achashverosh to save the Jews. So from the moment she went willingly, she became forbidden to her husband. The Gemara famously puts this onto the words of Esther. She says, "Kasher avadeti, avadeti." That which I'm going to lose, is referring to the fact that she won't be able to return to her husband. That's true. So maybe Ya'el also she became forbidden to her husband. That could be. Some of the Mepharshim don't like that because later on, we're going to see in the next parak, when it refers to Ya'el, so it calls her Ya'el Eshes Chevra Keni, Ya'el the wife of Chevra Keni. Now if she became forbidden to her husband after this story, it's a little bit difficult to say, like, why would the Navi call her the wife of somebody that she's forbidden to remain married to? So they want to say that maybe she wasn't forbidden to him. And then the question is why? So one answer they cite is that there's a famous thesis at the beginning of Masechas Ksuvos, Daf Gimel Amud Beis. So thesis brings the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam says that if a married Jewish woman cheats on her husband with a guy, so she doesn't become forbidden to her husband.
Yes,
what? What did you say?
Yes,
right. So Rabbeinu Tam says because the having relations with a guy is going to be tantamount to having relations with an animal. And just like if a married woman would commit bestiality, she doesn't become forbidden to her husband. So if a married woman also commits adultery with a guy, she doesn't become forbidden to her husband. Like, what's his name? Rabbi Kagan said, Tosis brings a pasuk that says, Zerma susim zermasam. The flow of a horse is their flow. It's referring to the flow of their semen. Right, so it's like the flow of a horse. A guy's semen is like the semen of a horse. It doesn't forbid a married Jewish woman to her husband. That's Rabbeinu Tam's opinion.
Oh.
What? Oh. But we don't paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. So, but this is Rabbeinu Tam. The Ria argues with Rabbeinu Tam. We don't paskin like this. But if you want to go like Rabbeinu Tam, so you can answer. Okay, Ya'el cheated on her husband with Sisera, doesn't forbid her to her husband, so it's not a problem. But we don't paskin like Rabbeinu Tam. We paskin like the Ria. So it's a little bit of a question of how it works out, how Ya'el would be permitted to her husband, or if she would be permitted to her husband. Some people point out there's a medrash called Medrash Tadshe, and in Medrash Tadshe it says that Ya'el Eshes Chevra Keni was a Giyaris. She was a convert to Judaism. So you could say that maybe this story actually happened before she converted to Judaism. Maybe she and her husband weren't even Jewish. Some people say this. She wasn't even Jewish. She was an ally of the Jewish people, but she herself and her husband maybe were not even Jewish. So then it's not a problem. There's no halacha by Goyim that if a married woman cheats on her husband, she becomes forbidden to her husband, so that's not a problem. There's another point over here. The Gemara says, the famous Gemara in Maseches Gittin, people might have seen this on Tisha B'Av when you were learning if you were learning the Gemara, they're allowed to learn about on Tisha B'Av. So the Gemara says that Mibnei Banav Shel Sisera Lamdu Tinekes B'Yerushalayim. From the sons of Sisera, the descendants of Sisera, taught Torah, taught children in Yerushalayim. The descendants of Sisera, where it seems to be that there were some Rebbe, Cheder Rebbe's in Yerushalayim. The Gemara explains it's talking about Shmaya and Naftalion. Shmaya and Naftalion were the Rebbe of Hillel, the Rebbe of Hillel and Shammai. They were the leaders in the generation before Hillel and Shammai. So Shmaya and Naftalion, which they themselves were converts, and they were descendants of Sisera. There's another fascinating thing. I don't know what his source for this is, but there's a Ramami Panu, Rabbi Menachem Azariah of Fanu, one of the great Kabbalists who lived in the same time as Darizal. So he writes that Ya'el became pregnant from we said that according to the Gemara, Sisera had relations with Ya'el 7 times. The Gemara points in the next parak in the Song of Devorah. So there's a pasuk that uses 7 verbs when it's talking about what Sisera did. Bein Ragleha, this is Pasuk Perek Hey Pasuk Chav Zayin. It says Bein Ragleha, between her legs, Kora Nofal Shachav, he crouched, he fell, he lied. Bein ragleha kara nafal. Between her legs, he crouched and he fell. Kasher basher kara sham nafal shadud. And when he crouched, there he fell, shadud, captured or pirated or commandeered. So it uses seven verbs when it's talking about what happened with Sisera. And the Ramami Panu, this great Kabbalist, writes that the third verb, shachav, he said, represents the third act of intercourse between Sisera and Yael. And the Ramami Panu says that from the third act of intercourse, Yael became pregnant, and from that, Rabbi Kiva was born. That's what the Ramami Panu says. So take with that what you want.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What's the source?
I mean, the Ramami Panu, I don't know what his source for this is. I mean, the Ramami Panu himself is a source. But it's a very interesting thing. I mean, we know that Rabbi Kiva is his father is Ben Gerim, so he's a descendant. It could be his descendant of Yael or Sanchar, Sisera. Not sure.
It's not the exact father.
What? No, not the father. Yeah, doesn't literally mean. I mean, descended from that third act of intercourse.
Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
But I think there's also the Ramami Panu. The Ramami Panu says about Devorah that Devorah was a Gilgal, a reincarnation of Tzipora, the wife of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah, and he says.
Is there another woman you say was a reincarnation?
What? Yeah, that was a similar thing that we saw a few days ago about what's it called? About the Achsa in the first year. Yeah, but he says that the Devorah was a reincarnation. It's not. It doesn't contradict each other. There's different aspects, and in different ways, they were a reincarnation of a similar concept of an aspect of the person. It doesn't mean that it has to be. You know, it doesn't necessarily contradict each other. But the Ramami, I think it's the Ramami Panu says this, that Tzipora, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't take her with him when he went to Egypt to take the Jews out of Egypt. He left her behind. And there's a machlokas when she and her father came back, when Yisro and came with his daughter Tzipora and Moshe Rabbeinu's kids, when they came and rejoined Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people. Well, according to one opinion, she came. What's the machlokas if they came before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah? Did Yisro return before Matan Torah or after Matan Torah? But it seems that everyone agrees that Yisro and Tzipora and Moshe Rabbeinu's sons were not there for the Yetzias Mitzrayim, and they were not there for, let's say, the pinnacle of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is the Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea. And therefore, Tzipora didn't have a chance to take part in the splitting of the sea and in the song that the Jewish people sang after the splitting of the sea. Yeah? So the Ramami Panu says that Devorah, as a Gilgul of Tzipora, she had to come to rectify that, and Tzipora wasn't able to sing a song of praising Hashem, but Devorah is going to be able to sing a song of praising Hashem. And that's the next parak in Shoftim, parak Hey, begins, V'toshar Devorah Barak ben Avinom Bayamu Ulemor. Devorah and Barak ben Avinom sang on that day, saying, and now V'toshar is actually, grammatically, Vatashar means and she sang, right? So and Devorah and her and Barak sang, but the verb used is Vatashar, she sang, right? You would have thought it should say Vayishru, they sang, Devorah and Barak sang together, plural, but here it's Vatashar singular, she sang, right? Again, this points to the idea that Devorah is the main player over here and Barak is the secondary player, but also because it's also pointing to this idea that this song has to do specifically with Devorah. So this is the whole chapter, the whole parak Hey over here goes to this whole long song, very beautiful song that Devorah sang, singing the praises of Hashem for saving the Jewish people. If we want, we can go through every single pasuk in this song, and we can have like 2-3 shurim just on this song, and go through it and see all the amazing things that you see in this. But I don't think that that's appropriate for our framework over here. So we're going to sort of get some bullet points of the song, and then we'll finish off, and then we'll go to the next thing next time we learn. There's a medrash that says that compares this to Kriyas Yamsuf. First of all, we mentioned that when Devorah had her original prophecy, she said that she said to Barak, go take the army to Har Tavor, and I'm gonna, and Hashem says, and I'm gonna draw the army of Sisera and Yavin to Nachal Kishon, right? And that's where the battle is gonna be at Nachal Kishon. Chazal tells us in Maseches Pesachim that what happened was that there's a connection between this story and the story of the splitting of the sea, of Kriyas Yamsuf, of the splitting of the Red Sea. Chazal tell us that when Hashem split the sea by the Egyptians and swallowed up the Egyptians, so Hashem said to the sea afterwards, spit out the Egyptians so that the Jews could take the spoils of the war, the booty from the war. And the sea said to Hashem, no, I'm not split. You gave me these Egyptians as a present. Why should I get rid of them? I want them as a present. You gave it to me, I swallowed it up, so I should get to keep them. So Hashem says to the sea, look, we'll make a deal with you. You spit out the Egyptians so that the Jews can take the spoils of the war. At a different time, I'll give you people to extra people to swallow up. And the sea says, okay, fine, deal. And so by Kriyas Yamsuf, the sea swallowed up the Egyptians, spit them out, and the Jews were able to get all the gold and silver and all the other jewelry that the Egyptians had taken with them to go to this war.
How does that?
What?
Doesn't make any sense. How is Hashem making a deal with the Yamsuf? Hashem created the Yamsuf.
Yeah, it's a good question. We find these different midrashim that speak about the, let's say, the Tsar, the officer, or the prince of different aspects of nature, as if they have independent wills in order to teach us a lesson. So yes, Hashem created the sea, and Hashem created the, let's say, the spirit that represents the sea, the Tsar of the Yam. But Hashem also made this whole conversation happen in order to teach us a lesson.
Actually, you could say the same thing about a person, because Hashem created us too. I think the difference is...
No, people have free will, but let's say the sea doesn't have free will.
Right, that's the difference.
Yeah, that's the difference. But it's coming to teach us a lesson. It's not, you know, it's not like the sea actually was going to be able to go against what Hashem wanted.
Right.
Right? So the sea, what the Gemara says is that over here in the story of the war with Sisera, Nachal Kishon swallowed up the Canaanites and it took them in. So that's one way that this story parallels the story of Kriyas Yamsuf. And the Medrash Lekach Tov in Parshas Beshalach says that a difference between our story and the story of Kriyas Yamsuf is that by Kriyas Yamsuf, first the men sang a song, Oz Yashir Moshe Uvnei Yisrael, and then after the whole thing of Oz Yashir, after the Jewish men sing their song praising Hashem, so then it says, and Devorah came, and Miriam came with the tupim biyada, and she sang Shir Hashem Ki Gagal Sisvach Vayam Avayam. And Miriam came, and she led the women and sing a song afterwards. So, but Kriyas Yamsuf, it was the men and then the women. Over here in this story, the Medrash says it was the women and then the men. Vatashar Devora, and Ubarak Ben Avinom. It was the women who were initiating the singing of the praises. We have different, you know, in Tanakh we have different songs that were said, you know, it's called the Shira. There's a measure that there were 10 Shiras. There's different types of Shiras that we find in the entire Tanakh. And the Shira, if you look, are written in a special way. They're written like this. It's called Ariach Agabe Levena. It's written as if it's sort of structured as if it's like bricks. Right, like bricks, you don't put them all on top of each other lined up. You put one, and then on the next level you put two underneath that one, and then on the next level you put one underneath those two. Right, so that's how these songs are structured. And Oz Yashir and Chumash is also structured in that way. So there's a medrash that says that there were three people that had special songs through Ruach HaKodesh. There's Moshe Rabbeinu, David HaMelech, and Devorah. They had special songs through Yochah. So Moshe Rabbeinu has Oz Yashir after Kriyas Yamsuf, and then you have also Hazinu Moshe Rabbeinu, and then you have David HaMelech towards the end of his life, after he had defeated all of his enemies, so he sings this long epic song for Hashem. And then we have the story of Devorah over here. And there's a connection between these songs. Very interesting that we read this story of Oz Yashir, the story of Kriyas Yamsuf, we read it twice a year. We read it once when we read Parshas Beshalach in the Chumash, in the regular order of the Chumash, Parshas Beshalach, and when we read it in Parshas Beshalach, that Shabbos is called Shabbos Shira, the Shabbos of the song. It's a special Shabbos that's dedicated to the song. And when we read it on Shabbos Shira, the Haftarah that we read after Kriyas HaTorah on that Shabbos is the story of Devorah. The story of Devorah and the song of Devorah. Or actually, I think that Ashkenazim do the story of Devorah and the song, and I think Spartim just do the song. Is that true? I think that's true. Let me look it up in a second. Yeah, Ashkenazim do the story and the song, and the Sephardim just do the song. Interesting. We also read about Kriyas Yamsuf on the seventh day of Pesach, which was the day of the year that it happened on. Right? We read Oz Yashar then, and when we read it then, so there we don't read the song of Devorah as the Haftarah, there we read the song of David HaMelech as the Haftarah. So there's this connection in our liturgy between these three songs that were said with Ruach HaGodesh of Moshe, David, and Devorah. So just to briefly go through the song, she praises all the people that helped her win the war, the tribes of Naphtali, Yisachar, and Zebulun that were involved. And then she sort of rebukes or blasts the tribes that didn't help her, of Ephraim and Binyamin and Reuven, all these different tribes that came up with all kinds of excuses why they didn't want to partake in this battle. And Dan didn't partake. Gilad is another name for the half of Menasheh that was east of the Jordan. So she talks about who helped and who didn't help. And then it talks about this thing about the Nachal Kishon swallowing up the Canaanites. It says Nachal Kishon grofam, Nachal Kishon swept them away, Nachal Kedumim. Nachal Kishon. Nachal Kishon is a Nachal Kumim. It's an ancient Nachal. It's an ancient river or an ancient brook. So that's where the Gemara connects this to something that happened historically earlier and connects it to the Kriyas Yamsuf with that deal. And then she makes an interesting. It talks about how. It says Min Shomayim Nilchamu Hakeichavim Misilaisam Nilchamim Sisra. From the heavens they fought the stars from their orbits. They battled against Sisra. Over here, Devorah is saying that all the mazalas and the different powers of the Kochavim and whatever, they also got involved and they helped the Jews also be able to defeat Sisra. And then it says, she's cursing someone who didn't really help out. It says, Oru Merois Omar Malach Hashem. Cursed be Meroz, says the angel of Hashem. Oru Yisrael, cursed be he, cursed be its inhabitants. Ki loy bo'u le'ezras Hashem, because they didn't come to help Hashem. Le'ezras Hashem ba'giborim, to help Hashem with the strong ones. So the Gemara says that Barak took 400 shofars, and he used that to make an excommunication, a cherem, against Meroz. So the question is, what is Meroz? So the Gemara might cut in the Tezayin and Aleph. The Gemara has two opinions. What is Meroz? Either Meroz was the name of a person, and he was some influential person who maybe had a city or town that he was in charge of, and he didn't decide to help out the Jews. Not sure if he was Jewish or if he wasn't Jewish, who exactly he was, but this Meroz guy, he didn't get involved, he didn't take the initiative, so Devorah and Barak are cursing him out. Right? That's one opinion of the Gemara. The other opinion of the Gemara, somewhat cryptically, the Gemara says, maybe Meroz, Yesham and Meroz was a kochav, was a star or planet. Right? Well, if you look closely, the lashon that we said over here is that Oru Yeshveha, cursed be its inhabitants. So what do you mean, if it's a planet or a star, what inhabitants does it have? Right? So Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan wants to point to this as proof that it could be there are life in other planets. It's an interesting idea. Some people consider this idea heretical. Some people think that, no, that's what it means. Very, very fascinating thing to think about. That's okay, fine. Continuing, it says, she praises another person who took an active role in this war. Tevorach Minashim Yoel Eshes Chever Akeni. Minashim Ba'oil Tevorach. Blessed be Yael, the wife of Eshes of Chaver Keni, right? We said before that that it mentions her as the wife of Chaver Keni. So here it's mentioning her, even though it's after the story, which seems to imply that they're still justified in being married. She should be blessed. People should be blessed by her. Minoshim ba'ohel tivarech. She should be blessed from amongst the women in the tents because she took the initiative. It says Mayim Shoal. He asked for water. Cholav Nasna. She gave him milk. Right, because milk makes a person tired, and then he was able to go to sleep, and then she was able to kill him without him fighting back. Some mafarshim say that milk makes a person drunk to some extent. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Some mafarshim say that in addition to the milk, she gave him wine also. So that's a
which milk though?
What?
Specified?
Which milk?
Yeah.
So in Tanakh. Generic milk is goat milk, correct? Yeah, goat milk. From what I understand, people started drinking cow milk in Europe. It's a European thing. In the ancient world, in the Levant, in the Middle East, people drank goat milk as the standard milk. In my house, we drink goat milk because some of my kids are like allergic or have problems digesting cow milk. So my wife buys goat milk and sheep's milk.
I went to this person's house. They only had goat milk.
So we also have cow milk sometimes, but yeah. So he talks about Eshes Chaver Keni. Then there's this verse that we mentioned before. Between her legs, he fell down, whatever. Fine. And just two, three more points before we finish. This is towards the end of the song. So Devorah says, "Ba'ad hacholoi nishkafa v'tiyabev." From through the window, she was peeking out. And she was sobbing. Aim Sisra, Ba'ad HaNeshem, the mother of Sisra, was peeking from out the window and she was crying. Madua Baishesh Rechboi Lovoi, why is his chariot delaying in coming? Madua Echaru Pame Markavoisov, why are the hoofbeats of his carriage so late? And the Medrash tells us that every day Sisra would come to his mother at 3 hours into the day and he would be with his mother. He would hang out with his mother. And here, yeah, mommy's boy. And here, it was 6 hours into the day, and he still hasn't come. So she's like worried about him, like, where is he? Little does she know that sister has been defeated. She's so confident that her son is going to win that like it never occurred to her that he's going to lose this battle. And it says that her friends, sister's mother's friends, are sort of consoling her. They're saying, "Don't worry, he's probably busy dividing up the spoils of war." And her friends are going into details. There's colored garments and colored embroidery and all these different things. And they're splitting it up, so it's taking some time. So that's why he's coming late. But the little did they know that actually sister had lost the war, and that wasn't why he was coming late. He's just coming late because he's the late, the late sister. Over here, it's interesting that the song of Devorah focuses on Sisra's mother, right? This is sort of plays well with sort of the theme of our whole story. We started off that Devorah is the main character in the story. She's the female prophet and the female judge, which is sort of out of the ordinary. But then we had that Barak was gonna fight and he didn't want to go without Devorah, and Devorah says, "Yeah, fine, you'll win, but the glory is not going to go to you. The glory is going to go to a woman." Who's the woman? Yael. Right? So the other hero in the story was also a woman. Right? So it makes sense that at the end of the story, we're focusing on Sisra. We're not focusing on what was Sisra's dad thinking. We're focusing on what was Sisra's mother's reaction that she was crying. And we're focusing on the mother. Because for some reason, this story is focusing on the female. Because it shows the power of the female person that's behind the successful man. Of Devorah behind Barak, right? There is an interesting medrash that says that Sisra's mother cried 100 cries, and because of that, we blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah 100 times, which is somewhat bizarre because, like, why are we doing something corresponding to Sisra's mother crying? Some people said that it's a mistake and it's really supposed to refer to Sarah Imenu crying 100 cries after by Kedas Yitzchak. But there is this medrash that it's Baruch Hashem that Sisra's mother cried 100 cries, and that's it. Fine. And then the song ends off with famous words, "Kein yevdu kol avecha Hashem, so shall Hashem destroy all his enemies, v'oyhavav, and those who love Hashem, Kitzes Hashemesh Bigvurasai. They should be powerful like the rising sun. What does it mean they should be powerful like the rising sun? Who are the ones that love Hashem? And what does it mean they should be powerful like the rising sun? Rashi says, that the sun is going to be even more powerful than it is, and the ones who love Hashem, they should be also equally powerful. Rashi said, the Mufarshim said that the sun is going to be 49 times more powerful in the Mashiach's times than it is now. So they're saying that the tzaddikim, the ones who love Hashem, they should also be equally powerful. And the Gemara in Maseches Gittin, on page Lamed Vav Amid Beis, takes this pasuk of the Ayav of Ketzes Hashemesh Bigvurasai, those who love Hashem should be as powerful as the sun when it comes out, but applies it to a specific type of tzaddik, to a specific type of righteous person. It says, Tanu Rabbanan, Hane'elovin ve'enan oilvin, those who have become embarrassed, or those who are insulted and don't insult others, Shoymin Charpasan ve'en Meshivin, they hear their disgrace but they don't answer back, Oisin me'ava usmechen b'yisurin, and they do mitzvahs out of love of Hashem, and they are happy to receive yisurin, to receive suffering from Hashem, because they recognize that that's a way of atoning for their sins. Alehen hakosav omer, about these people the pasuk says, oyvav kitzetz Hashem eshbeg v'rosei, those who love Hashem should be as powerful as the sun when it's coming out. So who is this? Those people that love Hashem, the people that they don't answer back when they're embarrassed, the people that do mitzvahs out of love for Hashem, the people that recognize the value in the suffering that Hashem gives them, that's their lot, they recognize it, that's those who love Hashem should be as powerful as the sun when it first comes out. But then, the last words of the chapter, which all the Mepharshim speak out, even though it's written as if it's part of the song, right, it's written in this format, but it's not really part of the song. And the land was tranquil for 40 years, which means that Devorah was the Shofetes, she was the judge over Kal Yisrael for 40 years. I didn't have a chance to see in the Mepharshim if this includes the 20 years that they were subjugated under the dominion of Sisera and Yavin. I'm not sure if these 40 years include those 20 years, but Devorah was the judge for 40 years. And now everything is hunky-dory, and they're fine and dandy, and they're doing good. Except that, as we will see next time, same bat channel, that after Devorah dies, so then the Jews fall down again, and start doing averas, and then get subjugation, and then we're going to have another shofet to save them, etc., etc. This cycle will begin again next Monday at 3:30.
See you then.